The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I'm going to be reading to you from National Geographic. But before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we are going to journey into China, where writer Justin Jen takes us high on China's Jingmai Mountain. There, indigenous tea growers are holding fast to ancient techniques defying modern farming and producing a premium tea that has never been more popular. Into the Forest of the World's Finest Tea appeared in the January 2025 issue of National Geographic. So if you've ever wanted to learn more about tea, this is your chance. So come on and join us as we take this on. In a high-elevation forest on Jingmai Mountain, dawn broke over a green peak, bathing an ancient tea tree in warm light. A four-foot-wide trunk, along with enormous branches stretching up into a canopy of leaves, gave it an imposing bearing, nothing like the smaller tea shrubs often packed into tight rows on commercial farms throughout China. But this tree, deep within the southwestern Yunnan province, was different, and it served a different purpose altogether. A married couple named Ai Rong, and who is 41, and Ke Lanfang, 36, had gathered with their elderly parents in front of the tree, chanting a prayer in the blind people's language, spoken by the indigenous community throughout this region, where five tea forests, collectively the oldest and largest on the planet, are cultivated. To the untrained eye, the tree might have been merely a part of a forest, but for the family, it was the heart of a living shrine. They prayed to their tea spirit tree, asking an ancestor named Pa'aling, now considered a deity, to deliver a strong harvest. "It's 1,000 years old," I said proudly, pointing to the tree's large trunk. In recent years, however, his faith seemed to be continually tested. At a time when the region's highly specialized tea has gained widespread attention, commanding impressive prices, there are ever more unpredictable natural forces to contend with. Tea is the world's most popular beverage after water. Globally, people drink an estimated 45 billion gallons of it each year in a wide range of styles, from green to black and oolong. While these varieties exist because of different processing techniques, they all originate from the same fundamental ingredient, and that's Camellia sinensis. The species of flowing evergreen has traveled the world, most notably when the colonial British brought it to India in the early 19th century, breaking China's monopoly. Today, however, one specific style remains inextricably tied to Jingmai Mountain. For more than a millennium, the Mlang people, along with other indigenous group called the Dai, are believed to have continually maintained these ancient groves of Camellia sinensis var assamica, a subtype that produces black tea, including the mountain's dark, rich Puar tea. Now, the coveted blend has been referred to as drinkable gold among some tea connoisseurs, in part because many producers ferment it for a minimum of 10 years, which creates a deeper flavor and increases its worth. Among China's growing affluent class, the nutty, earthy, and slightly bitter concoction has been compared to fine wine. It softens and becomes more complex and collectible with age. I and his family own a plot of about 4,000 trees, but had spent years struggling to earn a profit. Then in 2015, they decided to partner with a premium brand that sells high-end Puar. They are now running a farm collective that employs workers throughout the area to help process tea from 37 different households, yielding about a ton of product annually. The Puar is pressed into circular cakes and aged, then packaged and sold for $330 per 12.6-ounce cake. Within Jingmai, the average income is significantly higher than it was two decades ago. For I and Kay, such gains and their entrepreneurial success have led to a combined income of around $40,000 a year, more than the average household in the nearby city of Humen. 2 years ago, UNESCO formally recognized Jingmai Mountain as a World Heritage Site, an honor reserved for places that provide unique cultural value. It is the only site related to tea cultivation. Perhaps not coincidentally, the price of tea from Jingmai has roughly doubled since the idea of a certification was introduced more than a decade ago. The region's 6,000 residents use natural practices to manage 3,900 acres with over a million trees. But their model of sustainability is facing new stresses from climate change. In the spring of 2024, the region was coping with its most severe drought in 60 years, and an unusually warm winter had brought an unexpected worm infestation to the peak that I's family was preying on, threatening the precious tea leaves just before harvest. The Blang people's tea spirit is based on a real person. Around the 10th century, according to oral history, Pa Aling led his people to settle in Jingmai, where he discovered the medicinal properties of wild tea plants and began to domesticate them. Near the end of his life, Pa imparted wisdom that's still recounted by farmers like I and Keh. "You can give you cattle, but they might die of diseases," Pa is remembered to have said. "Or I can give you cattle," he said. "I can give you gold, but you might squander it. So I'm going to give you tea trees, which can provide riches for generations." Well, Jingmai's closely managed lands may appear untamed, in contrast to terraced monoculture tea plantations seen throughout the world. But the canopy of trees provides shelter for tea plants that grow best in shade. A vibrant understory of ferns and herbs carpets the forest floor, fostering a rich habitat of fauna while helping the soil retain vital moisture. Now, the tea plant sanctuaries are also divided into distinct pockets, strategically partitioned by forest that separates one plot from another to stop the spread of diseases and pests. The Blang people believe that everything has a soul, a reminder to leave nature undisturbed, so in tending the forest, they avoid pesticides and herbicides, as well as aggressive practices such as pruning. Keh cuts grass between the trees only twice a year and with a knife. New research shows the agroforestry techniques practiced in Jingmai continue to be effective. A recent study by Minsu University of China found that tea produced from the mountain's high-altitude trees was less bitter than tea cultivated from trees at lower altitude, and the sustainable farming methods supported significantly higher biodiversity than commercial tea gardens. Jingmai's tea current price is about 6.5 times higher than that of typical plantations. Despite his family's owning thousands of venerable tea trees, I lived in poverty during his childhood because of demand for their product was non-existent. During the second half of the 20th century, China's focus on mass production from high-yield, large terrace plantations left little room for the old trees' labor-intensive harvest. While growers across other Yunnan tea mountains raised their ancient groves to plant younger, more productive trees, the people of Jingmai remained steadfast in protecting their arboreal treasure. Now, their commitment was reinforced by practical constraints. Without modern roads, their old trees were ill-suited for mass production. The indigenous communities persevered with their seemingly unkempt forest. Jingmai's fortunes changed around 2000 when the Chinese government invested in new roads and electricity for rural areas. Slowly, new tea buyers began to arrive at the mountain, even as increased access led to more challenges. Some villagers destroyed parts of the forest to harvest timber for new construction. Others applied harmful chemicals to their trees and pruned aggressively to boost profits. By 2003, Su Guowen, a retired primary school teacher who claims to be a descendant of Pa Aling, felt the need to act. At community meetings, he invoked Pa's purported instruction to protect the forest, like your own eyes, arguing that the continued preservation of ancient practices and traditions would bring growers long-term benefits, even if they had to sacrifice short-term yield. Village chief Ai Sen also rallied the Dai people to protect their crafted biospheres. Both pushed for bans on clear-cutting and chemical use. Around 2010, that movement gained more speed when village elders joined forces with the Chinese government to petition for World Heritage status. As part of the government's push, authorities put a checkpoint on the single road leading up to Jingmai Mountain to stop people from bringing in non-native plants and animal species, built a road using stones rather than asphalt, which might disrupt the aromas of the tea, and formally restricted construction and deforestation in the area. Zhu Jing, a professor at Anhui University, joined the effort to help document the area's distinct cultural heritage. His government-funded team also built eco-friendly model homes to demonstrate how some modern technologies vastly improve sanitation, heating, and power, while preserving the ancient architecture, something the community quickly adopted. Jingmai Mountain is like an old tree that has both a unique history and a powerful contemporary life force that continues to grow, he says. Around the time of their family's prayer ceremony, I and Ke joined the spring harvest, performed with an age-old meticulous attention. Members of the Blang Dai and other groups wore lightweight shoes and carried large baskets gently slung across their shoulders as they carefully moved through their rugged parcels, scanning the ancient trees for their most tender shoots before carefully stepping over different branches to hand-pick them. This ensured nothing would be crushed, and the dried leaves would unfurl into a beautiful shape when finally brewed. Once their basket brimmed with fresh leaves, I and Ke returned home to start the intricate transformation process. They set out leaves to wither slightly while Ke prepared firewood for the crucial steaming or killing green, a step which would stop decomposition. I tossed the leaves into a hot wok, arresting oxidation, and the room filled with a pleasant, nutty aroma. As the leaves cooled down, Ke began the delicate step of hand-rolling, gently twisting each leaf to rupture its cells and release more flavor. After the leaves were carefully set out to dry, the tea was ready for pressing, packaging, and aging. This process yields new pu'er, a tea that still requires about a decade or more of maturation to reach its peak. The 2024 harvest was significantly impacted by the drought, even though it had been saved by some labor-intensive techniques. When the pest infestation broke out, I, Ke, and countless others worked tirelessly picking worms from the most important trees by hand for weeks. The infestation did not spread to other parts of the ancient forest, lending credence to the effectiveness of the partitions planted by the ancestors. In recent years, I and Ke have renovated the ground floor of their wooden home to host tea ceremonies for potential buyers, pouring graceful, unbroken ribbons of pu'er into porcelain cups. But their story is just one example of how the market for Jingmai tea continues to flourish. Today, 90% of the region's income comes from tea. The younger generation even live streams tea tastings to a growing audience of digital devotees across China. And the residents in the villages of Wingji and Nuang, cited by UNESCO as architectural gems, have turned their traditional wooden houses into charming shops. Some have built temperature and humidity-controlled warehouses to store tea cakes, a nod to their increasing value and a bet that in time they might evolve into valuable antiques. Last May, a rare tea cake from the province, estimated to be from 1917, fetched an astonishing $448,057 at auction in Hong Kong. Meanwhile, it seemed as if the dry spell would continue, so growers leaned into traditional beliefs to strengthen their resolve. Blang village elders tried to read chicken bones studded with toothpicks, an ancient divination ritual for climatic guidance. Members of the Dai community, which has different religious practices, implored the Buddha to intervene. The first downpour finally began in May, saturating the soil beneath the shady canopy. The rain swelled into a deluge as summer began. Jingmai remained resilient, as if by some larger design. Well, accompanying Justin Jin's article is another article titled Where the Tea Begins. It's actually a graphic with lots of captions. And it's written by Diana Marquez and Patricia Healy. Now, if you really ever wanted to learn more about tea, then you've come to the right place for this little five-minute primer. That's what I've characterized it as. And I think you'll enjoy some of the facts that are going to be presented. First of all, where the tea begins. Aside from water, tea is far and away the most popular drink in the world. Some estimates suggest we consume more than 2 billion cups of it every day. But not all of what's labeled as tea is actually that beverage. True tea is derived from a single plant, Camellia sinensis, which is grown in more than 45 countries and is processed to create six foundational varieties, each with its own flavor and characteristic profile. And these six are the Pu'er, green, black, yellow, oolong, and white. Now, when is a tea not a tea? Well, around the world, a huge number of non-traditional teas like chamomile, mint, and rooibos, collectively called tusangs, are created by infusing plants such as herbs and roots. So these are infused and created by men, if you will. Now, how tea works. Now, for the uninitiated, it can be easy to lump all caffeinated beverages together, but the differences between tea and coffee are vast. Both can increase alertness, but tea can also induce a sense of calm. Each of the six foundational styles of tea offers a different flavor and chemical characteristics that have been associated with potential health benefits. What about caffeine? Well, the psychoactive substance promotes concentration and reduces mental fatigue by binding to receptors in the brain, blocking messages that rest is needed. In other words, you're going to be awake and alert. And then we have the L-theine, this is found in tea plants, and a species of mushroom. This rare amino acid affects the nervous system. It soothes the restful sleep, moderating the action of caffeine while increasing your focus. Now, then we have the catechins. Now, studies suggest that these natural chemical compounds can boost cardiovascular health by relaxing blood vessels, improving flow. And then we have antioxidant effects on the body that are still being researched. And there is competition, and that competition made from roasted beans instead of leaves. Coffee lacks the relaxing compound L-theanine and has more caffeine than tea. So there you go. So let's take a look at how this works. Now, if you take a graph and you put all of these six varieties of tea leaves together, and you see at one corner in the upper side of this graph, you see promotes alertness, relaxation, and increased focus. And then you go to the right upper right-hand corner as you move across this graph, promotes alertness, no effect on relaxation or focus, okay? So in this one with high caffeine starting up here, we have yellow. And the minimal processing of yellow, green, and white. Now, the minimal processing of green tea, including matcha, helps retain catechins, the most abundant compounds in fresh leaves, yielding a light-colored infusion. Then we have yellow. The two palest and rarest of teas have subtle flavor. Yellow tea requires intensive processing. White tea's delicate young buds and leaves are hand-plucked. And now they have some recommended steeping temperatures for white, 180 degrees for 4 to 5 minutes steeping, 175 degrees if you make yellow for 2 to 3 minutes steeping, and then green, 175 degrees at 1/2 to 2 minutes. And that was something new to me. I thought it had to be closer to 200 degrees, but apparently not. That's overdoing it. And by the way, when you get to the green tea on this side, it's at the lower left-hand corner. That promotes relaxation and increased focus, but no effect on your alertness. And talking about white tea, when you do white tea, it enhances taste and aroma. Hotter water brings out caffeine and the astringency of catechins. Longer steeping returns a more savory infusion from the higher extraction of L-theanine. Now, speaking of that, let's go over to the other side of our graphic. So that was the first half. Now, the second half has oolong, black, and Puar. Oolong is at the upper side, in the middle is black, and down in the lower right-hand corner is Puar. And at the top, you're going to promote alertness, no effect on relaxation of focus. Now, Oolong's golden to amber color and black tea's red come from the conversion of compounds during a controlled oxidation process, which reduces L-theanine levels. And then you have black tea. And by the way, you want to make Oolong tea at a higher temperature. It's 195 degrees, and you steep it for 2 to 3 minutes. Black tea is 200 degrees, so that must be where I got that original temperature, thinking that applied to all teas. It does not. Anyway, 200 degrees and then 2 to 5 minutes for steeping. And then Puar is the only tea that's fermented. The ancient process helps to retain 1,000-plus compounds that give it a deep color and mellow, earthy flavor. And it's processed at 195 degrees Fahrenheit for the water and 5 minutes steeping. And there are hidden ingredients. The tea contains traces of iron, fluoride, and vitamin C, as well as insect genetic material, all often originating from the plant's growing environment. So there you go. Now, from one leaf, six styles. A remarkable diversity of flavors and chemical properties can be coaxed from a single plant depending on how it's processed. In addition to the refining steps shown here, flavor can be modified by using flowers, spices, or fruit to create variations like chai and Earl Grey. Now, when you look at this little graph, we're going to have green, yellow, white, oolong, black, and puar. Those are the six varieties. And then you have these processes that they talk about. Withering. Leaves are spread out, losing moisture and becoming soft and leathery. Taste and aroma begin to change as proteins start breaking down. And then you have de-enzyming. Heating by pan, roasting, or steaming deactivates the enzymes responsible for decomposing the leaves. The natural process of oxidation is then stopped. Now, you have some change of color, too, for some of these, especially oolong and black, as you go into oxidizing. Degrading cells by tumbling and crushing leaves increases surface contact with oxygen. The controlled reaction alters the flavor and turns green into darker shades. Then we get down to something called smothering. Now, in this process step, unique to yellow tea, the warm and damp leaves are covered lightly, causing green leaves to turn yellow and taste sweeter. Then we've got something called shaping, machines that knead, twist, or roll leaves, turn them from wrinkled strips into twisted, curly, spherical, or flat shapes. Shaping is also done by hand. Then we have the drying process. This step aims to reduce water content until no more than a fraction of the total weight remains hydrated, which improves transportation and shelf life. And then finally, fermenting, a controlled fermentation by naturally occurring or introduced fungi, takes place while leaves piled or pressed into bricks are left to age sometimes for decades. And this applies solely to the Puar variety of tea. So there, my friends, is more than you need to know about tea, I'm sure, but I just wanted to make sure you got the message. Well, our journey now changes direction as we go from tea to monasteries, how historic monasteries became modern destinations. This is written by Julia Buckley, also appearing in the January 2025 issue of National Geographic. The editors note, across the Italian countryside, once sacred religious spots now offering tranquility to a new generation of travelers. So here's an excerpt from this wonderful article. David Gagrec first set eyes on the Italian sanctuary of La Verna on a school trip in 1994. Raised in Croatia to an Italo-Croatian family, Jagsic was just 14 years old at the time, but it was there at this friary nestled in the mountains of Tuscany that his life changed forever. It filled my heart, he says. The scent of the wood inside has always stayed with me. God spoke to me. Jagsic felt a calling inspired by La Verna. He took vows as a Franciscan friar and spent a year in training at the sanctuary in 2001. After 2 decades of postings to friaries around Tuscany and a year in Jerusalem, he returned to the mountain as Brother David, a Franciscan friar and vicar of La Verna. Now, founded by early followers of St. Francis in 1260, the sanctuary is one of hundreds of monasteries and friaries in Italy open to the public. These monasteries are often part of a cenobitic tradition based on the concept of life in common. But as these ancient Christian communities work to stay relevant to the modern world, their traditions are evolving. And by the way, this word Cenobitic is a monastic tradition, is what it means, okay? The buildings and sites are overseen by those Jassic are now destinations themselves and welcoming travelers of all religious backgrounds, seeking the serenity of Italy's countryside and mountains away from the bustling urban tourist hubs. For almost 15 centuries, monasteries, friaries, and sanctuaries have welcomed visitors to worship each day of the night or simply enjoy the views. The practice dates back to the medieval period when Italy was the home of countless hermits and groups of monachi or monks and frati, brothers or friars, who sought God through community. Medieval monasteries regularly hosted overnight guests, providing a safe place to stay for all. Now, St. Benedict's said to welcome guests as Christ himself, says Dom Maurizio Vavela, prior of the sanctuary of the Sacro Spico Holy Cave, a monastery grafted to the rock face in the central mountains of Lazio, where the saint lived as a hermit in the early 6th century. St. Benedict's directive, Bavera adds, applies to everyone, including people who come to the monastery solely for the beauty. He said that a hello isn't enough. You have to give them everything you can. That became the cardinal point of the Benedictine order. Now, visitors looking for contemplation, art, and food can drive, hike, and in the case of Liberna, even snowshoe toward an encounter with modern spirituality. Found in Tuscany's national park of the Casentinese Forest, Mount Valtellina and Campagna, Liberna welcomes around 600,000 visitors each year. Jassic estimates and is indelibly linked to St. Francis, who was gifted this mountain as a place of retreat by a noble in 1213. The saint would come to the area to roam the mountain, meditating in caves and on rocks. It's there in 1224 he is said to have received the stigmata, the wounds of Christ's crucifixion marked on his hands, feet, and side. The centuries roll back on the 7-minute stroll from the parking area as rippling mountains furred with a thick canopy of silver firs and beeches glisten in gold each fall. By the time visitors reach the monastery, which clings to the cliffside, the abyss falling beneath it, it's as if they've arrived in the 13th century when Francis's followers started construction after his death. Descending the cliff down 89 precipitous steps, visitors will reach a liminal space of moss-slicked boulders, among the same that Francis commuted with in the in the 1220s. He is said to have preferred one rock cleaved down the middle, an echo of the heavens rending when Christ died on the cross to pray on. For Jassic, this area, not the monastery above, is Liberna's true sanctuary. Many come in search of something spiritual in a generic sense. There are a lot of people looking for something, he says. At Liberna, says Jassic, our mission is moving from the church to the guest house. Once the monastery gates close for the evening, amid the hoots of owls and the songs of birds beloved by St. Francis, overnight guests can connect with their own version of the divine. The Casentinese Forest are often dubbed the sacred forest because of their centuries-long monastic presence. Not all Italian monasteries allow overnighting. Not all have monks or friars either. The Sacro di San Michele floats above the clouds in the Piedmont Alps, an area over the Susa Valley, 3,100 feet below. Now, its sinuous battlements melt into the mountain as if wrapping the landscape in an embrace, an architectural symbol that echoes ancient depictions of the Madonna of Mercy sweeping her cloak around the faithful. And that, my friend, brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Travel. We hope you've enjoyed the journey and that you'll join us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice, all one word, .org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.